and about us should impact our approach to sinners. Though I know it could sound a little funny to put it like that, because obviously we're all sinners. So there's not a group of non-sinners and sinners out there or in here either, right? We're all sinners. But there are sinners who have been saved, and there are sinners who have not. That's a distinction the Bible makes. It's not us coming up with it. There are people who are lost, and there are people who are found. And while it might make some feel uncomfortable to talk like that, the Bible talks like that. There are people who are Christians, and there are people who are not. And we're asking, what is our approach to people who are not? How should what we say we believe about what God's done through Jesus impact the way we relate to all these people around us who don't seem to care that much about what we believe about Jesus, and whose lives maybe to us sometimes can seem really, really broken and complicated? And I'm not saying everything that needs to be said right now, but I do want to try to be real, because there are people out there who are going to be hard for us. And knowing what to do exactly in real life can sometimes feel a little complicated when you're interacting with somebody and you've got to make a decision. It's not always easy in specific situations to know the exact right thing you're supposed to do. And I'm not going to try to give you all the answers right now, for sure. That's not the point, because I don't have them. And there are definitely times where I have been confused, like, what do I do? What do I say? What is the next right step? But I want to talk about how the gospel should impact what's going on in your heart in the middle of all that. Because if that's not right, nothing is going to be right. Even if we did know the right thing to do, it's even more important it's coming from the right heart. We've got to be working at applying the way God is saving sinners to the way we think and feel and what we do as we interact with people in this world. That is like priority number one. And yet, I want us to stop and think about the difference the gospel makes in our approach, because it's surprisingly easy not to do that and to interact with sinners in a way that is really different than how you would expect we would if we really believe God's doing what we say he's doing through Jesus. It's really easy to have an approach to sinful people that doesn't make sense in light of the gospel. And that's basically what this text is about. Jesus is explaining and defending his approach to sinners and calling on religious people to have the same attitude that he did. Though, of course, as we look at Luke 15, we've got a little work to do now as Christians when we study this, because this is all pre-cross. So it's like we're going to have to go back in time a little to take this and try to apply it to ourselves, which, of course, is what we're supposed to do at the end of the day. But I think it's kind of important at the start, at least, to understand that as this is happening here in Luke 15, there's a sense in which there aren't even Christians yet, because this is all going on before the church got started. But still, there's Jesus. There's Jesus, this one that we are supposed to follow. And there's this nation, Israel, who is supposed to be the people of God. So we're looking at Jesus and we're looking at Israel, this group that God's working with at this point that he promised to send the Messiah for, who would come and provide salvation for his people. And in Israel, there were people who would have said, we want that salvation, who would have said, we believe the Bible, and we want the Messiah to come. And there were also people who weren't really living like that at all. They weren't keeping the law, and they weren't waiting for the kingdom of God to come. And before Jesus, you wouldn't have thought they had much interest at all in salvation. And one of the things that was making religious people, the people who would have said, we believe in the Bible, and we want the Messiah to come, so upset with Jesus, was the way that Jesus was interacting with the people who weren't. Because he was out there offering the kingdom to them if they would just come to him. And that's actually pretty much the background for Luke 15, because Jesus is telling a couple stories here that we're familiar with, like the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the prodigal son. But he's telling these stories in the middle of a debate, basically, that the religious leadership of Israel was having with him about the proper approach to sinners, because Jesus has one approach and they have a different one. And in Luke 14, Jesus told them, the chapter right before this, that their approach needs to change because they're getting it wrong. So they need to humble themselves because the kingdom of God was going to be filled up with people who did not deserve it, and that should cause them to change who they eat with. He literally says that. What's going to happen in the end should change who they eat with. And yet they clearly don't agree, because in Luke 15, they come back and they're grumbling about Jesus, verses 1 and 2. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him, and the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." And when it says they grumbled, it means they're making a judgment. As they see these people who weren't keeping the law and who weren't interested in the kingdom, all of a sudden coming to Jesus to learn, they are not excited. And the reason they're not excited is because of the way Jesus is relating to these people. Because he's welcoming them like they are his friends. That's the word receives. And he's eating with them. And it's just so absolutely shocking to them. And it seems so wrong that it's like they can't see anything else. And the thing is, if you ask them what bothered them so much, they would have given religious reasons and felt totally justified avoiding these people and about being upset that Jesus didn't, because of how they thought the kingdom of God was supposed to work. They would have said, at least, that this was a doctrinal issue, because they would have said the way they related to sinners was because of what they thought about salvation, actually, because they were all about the law and believed it was important to keep yourself pure. And the way you kept yourself pure was by staying away from things that would make you impure. So they had this whole list of things they were trying to do to stay pure. And eating with someone who didn't keep the law was dangerous because they weren't doing all the stuff on their list, and their impurity could rub off on them and make them impure as well. And they didn't want that because they thought that God was going to send the Messiah to establish his kingdom for those who were demonstrating they were obedient to God's law, at least to their interpretation of it. And so they stayed away from tax collectors and sinners until those tax collectors and sinners changed and started keeping all the rules and regulations that they had been telling them to. And they just did not think you should have anything to do with them until they did, which, of course, is why they're grumbling about Jesus, because he clearly is seeking these sinners out. And Luke 15 is Jesus' response, or his explanation. He's responding to these religious people who thought it was too dangerous and too risky to interact with this group of people who they felt had not proven to be serious enough about their rules or even about the kingdom, and were sure that avoiding them and even honestly despising them was the right thing to do. Like, you know what? They're not doing what they're supposed to do. So just leave them alone, and if they're going to get it right, they're going to have to do that themselves, and then we can talk. And Jesus is like, wait, what? That's what you're getting from the Old Testament? That's really what you're getting from all that study of the Old Testament that you're doing? Let's go back and think about this again. So he told them this parable, verse 3. And the word parable is important because this is a story, but it's more than a story. Jesus is making an argument, but in story form. So you have to think about it because it's not direct, like, hey, 1, 2, 3, you're getting this wrong. And at first, it seems kind of simple, even, as Jesus talks about this shepherd, about this woman, and about a father. But you look closer, and he's telling these stories to make a point that is actually pretty controversial. But he does it in this down-to-earth way without this super-in-your-face confrontational style, this time at least, to give the Pharisees another chance to think. It's like he's trying to come alongside these people who were not understanding what God was doing through him and felt so right about it that they weren't even questioning whether they could be wrong, because they already had this framework that they had developed that was so set in their minds, but was the wrong framework. And so Jesus is trying to shake them up a little because he wants them to look at it again, because he really wants them to repent. I mean, in spite of their pride and unwillingness to listen, he's still pursuing them. And he even ends this chapter with an invitation, basically, for them to come in and enjoy what God's doing through him. But he starts out with a story about a lost sheep and a lost coin, which, of course, are the stories that we looked at the past couple weeks, and I kind of wish we could look at them again, honestly, because Jesus is making a case, and it all goes together, this whole chapter. But he basically rebukes them. You are not doing what you're supposed to be doing, because shepherds are supposed to seek after sheep. So I came to do it for you. And that was connected to this Old Testament passage they would have been familiar with. And their failure to seek those sheep is significant because it reveals they don't value what God values. They misunderstand God's priorities. There is more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than 99 who are doing what they're doing. And then he gives a beautiful picture of God's compassion as he illustrates God being like this woman searching for her lost coin, and says that there's joy in heaven over one single sinner who repents. And you remember, these parables are explaining what God is doing through Jesus in that moment. Jesus came to seek the lost, even though it might have seemed a little risky, like a shepherd who would leave the 99 sheep in the open country to go after the one sheep that was lost. And like a poor woman who would light her lamp with the little oil she has left so that she can see and find that one coin that she's lost. And he's finding them, Jesus, which is how the chapter begins, as all these tax collectors and sinners are drawing near to hear him. That's discipleship language here. But the reason they drew near to hear like that was because Jesus went out and sought them. And his strategy worked. Those lost individuals were being found, and that means forgiven, cleansed, made right with God, because Jesus was able to provide that for them. And Jesus' point in these first two stories is that should have been a cause for rejoicing to the Pharisees and the scribes. Obviously, instead of grumbling because of how God rejoices over repentant sinners, Jesus' attitude is God the Father's attitude. And that's the gospel principle we've got to get in our minds and in our hearts as we think about how to approach people around us who may seem so messed up. Because I know we don't always know what to do. But whatever we do, we need to know and believe that there's salvation for sinners in Jesus, and that God rejoices when people who don't deserve it are saved. And that's something that is a good thing to him. And we know that if we look at what's happening in Jesus's ministry, because he says these people who hadn't kept the law and weren't seeking the kingdom, now repenting, was something that was producing a lot of joy in heaven, because he was able to provide a salvation for them that religion couldn't. And he wanted them to enjoy that salvation. And the Father did too. And that's why he was going after them. And we should be following in his footsteps. Right? If he was seeking the lost in Israel, we should be seeking the lost by being willing and even seeking to get involved in the lives of broken people so that they can hear and understand the gospel, turn to Jesus, and be saved. That's a big part of our mission as a church, why we're on the planet, which I know probably sounds pretty obvious. Like, yeah, I've got that. But we all know, especially after you've been a Christian for a while, that our hearts can come up with a lot of reasons that doing that just doesn't make sense. Like, it's not practical. It, in theory, going after the lost, okay, that's one thing. We need to do it. But in reality, we go out there and we get involved in people's lives that are lost, and we find, man, there's a lot of complications. It doesn't usually make your life easier, because sin is insane. That's the truth. And when someone is stuck in sin, if you don't get close you might think they kind of have it together, and so we can all feel fine and get along. But when you start getting to really know them, the issues can multiply, and it feels overwhelming. And sometimes, though I don't think we would say it in church, but sometimes way deep down in our hearts where nobody can see, we might wonder if maybe we should just wait until people have their lives together first. Like, we'll do our thing, you do your thing, get it together, and then we'll talk. If we put it in the terms of these stories, you know, I'll rejoice when one sheep comes back. And I'll rejoice when I'm walking around and I see the coin accidentally. But I'm not going to light a lamp to find it. I'm not going to waste my oil. I mean, I know God rejoices over repentant sinners. And so when they do that, then I'll get involved. And I'll probably rejoice too. Which is a little different maybe than exactly how the Pharisees thought, if we look back at what was happening in this passage. But not that different, really. They didn't rejoice when they saw a sinner repenting and coming to Jesus for salvation because they didn't think that's how salvation worked. But they may have rejoiced if a sinner repented, if that meant they started keeping all their purity laws, because again, that's who they thought God was going to show his grace to. That was their gospel. With God's help, you can do this. In fact, if you want God's help, you must do this. Clean yourself up first. And Jesus is like, you know what? We've got to go back. And we got to look at this thing all over again. Because the way that you're relating to these people you're calling sinners reveals something is clearly not clicking in the way you think about God and about what God values and how God is working in this world. So let me tell you another story. Luke 15:11. And he said, there was a man who had two sons. And this story, I think, is where Jesus is really getting to work. Jesus is going after the Pharisees in the parable of the prodigal son and showing them what they're getting wrong in order to get them to repent, to understand what God's doing through him, to change their approach and to get on board with the program. And you know the story, of course, because it's so famous, but let's go through it super, super slow. It divides up into two sections, verses 11 through 24 and 25 through 32 are almost two stories, but they're definitely connected. And that's one of the things, actually, that makes this story different than the first two. They're kind of simple stories. This is a little more complex. And it's got three characters, and we meet them all in the first verse. Jesus says, there was a man. And even though we talk a lot about the parable of the prodigal son, this man seems to be the main character because he's in each part of the story, and it all revolves around him, really. There was a man. And then there were two sons. Verse 11, there was a man who had two sons, one who's younger and one who's older, which I guess is the way it normally works. And the older son comes at the end of the story, and the younger son is at the beginning. And he's the one that we're going to focus on now. And we're going to take a couple weeks to go through this parable because each character has something to teach us. But we're going to begin by looking at this younger son, who I hope is going to remind us of just how much grace there is in the gospel, because that's got to grip us if we're going to keep pursuing sinners. And when we start pulling back from pursuing sinners, I know there can be a lot of reasons, some good, some not so good, but if we start to pull back because we're feeling that person's too lost or some weird sense of superiority, that should be like a spiritual alarm that we need to go back and think about how salvation has to work, because we may be forgetting what we mean when we say it's got to be all God, which I think is what Jesus wants to teach the Pharisees, actually. And he does in kind of a surprising way, which I hope you'll see at the end. And you may have seen it this way before, but I didn't. Not until this time through the story of the prodigal son. And I think I didn't because normally, when I look at the parable of the prodigal son, I think of the younger son as representing the tax collectors and sinners, which of course isn't wrong. He does. There's maybe just something a little more we need to see about him. But let's at least start there because Jesus is giving an illustration of someone who is seriously lost. He says, there was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that's coming to me. And the property is his inheritance. Though he doesn't say inheritance, he says property, and he says it that way for a reason. But basically, he wants his father to give him his inheritance before the father dies, and he actually demands it. So this is a command, not a request. He says, give me. There's not even a please, which is pretty shocking. And I think it would be even now, honestly. Like if I went to my father and demanded he give me an inheritance, that would be very, very awkward. And I have a good relationship with my father, and he is very, very generous. But you start talking about an inheritance as if you deserve it, and that's weird, because you didn't do anything for it. Give me my inheritance. And when you talk about an inheritance, you're obviously talking about something you normally get after your father is dead while he's standing there right in front of you. And you know, if it would be awkward like that nowadays, it would be like 10 times more so back then. For one thing, because this was a patriarchal society. So you were always supposed to show deference to your father. Like that wasn't an option. You did not get to tell him what to do. And then, of course, the inheritance he was asking for was not going to be in stocks or bonds or like investments or money in the bank. It would have been property. Like, that's the word he uses, because it would have been land and things like that. So it's not like you're just asking your father, can I have $10,000? It's more like you grew up on the family farm, and you're asking the father, your father, to give you 100 acres when there's only 300. So this is a big sacrifice. To lose one-third of your total wealth like that would be a huge loss. And one that's not just going to impact the father, because everybody lived on this farm. And so it's going to impact your whole family, because that land is what's enabling all of you to survive. And of course, in Israel, we can ratchet it up a little bit, because land meant a little more to them than it does to us, because this is the promised land. And this property would have been in their family for generations as like a gift from God. And so asking for this property the way he does would have been pretty much unthinkable, especially because he doesn't just say, I want my inheritance, which would have been the easiest way for him to say it and would have been bad enough. But this is even worse. He says, give me the share of the property that falls to me. And so he doesn't use the word inheritance. Instead, he uses this super rare word that you don't find anywhere else in the New Testament. And they say probably the reason he uses that word is because in those days, an inheritance would have come with responsibilities. So if you accept an inheritance, one scholar explains, that means you accept leadership responsibility in your family clan. So give me the inheritance would be like, give me the money, but I'll step up and I'll do what needs to be done for the family. But the younger son actually does not want to do that, which is why he says it this way, give me the share of the property that falls to me, because that means he wants the money, basically, and that's it. And he's willing to break his relationship with his father and with his whole family to get it, which is why he doesn't seem to think being disrespectful is a problem, because at the end of the day, he is being incredibly disrespectful, and him asking for the property like this before his father dies is basically like him saying, Dad, I wish you were already dead. And so he is spitting on his father. And anyone hearing this story is going to think this is so shameful and even a little surprising, because it's not something that you heard of happening, like you might have heard about a shepherd losing a sheep or a woman losing a coin. That is something that happens, and you can relate to it, but a son doing this to his father would have basically been unheard of. And you know what's maybe even more surprising if you keep reading is that the father listens. Jesus says, and he divided his property between them. Just like that, without even blinking. And that's a different word than the word the son used. The word he uses here, Jesus, is the word bios, which probably biology students know is the word for life. He divided his life between them. And it puts it like that because this is what the father had to live on. And that's usually why parents hang on to their inheritance, because they need a way to survive as they get older. and they don't want their children to forget them, which unfortunately is a possibility, especially for this particular son, because he clearly does not care about his father's good. And yet the father doesn't even hesitate. He gives his sons what he had to live on. And he's given it to both of them, which is easy to overlook, I think. So if I ask you, what did the father do when the younger son demanded his inheritance? You might reply, he gave it to him. But what does it actually say? It says he divided his inheritance among them. And the older brother would have gotten more because they had rules about who got what part of the inheritance back then. And the older brother would have gotten 2/3 and the younger brother 1/3. So actually the older brother does pretty well. Though he's going to have to take care of his father still. And as long as his father's alive, his father still has kind of the authority. But at the same time, the older brother must have a little more freedom now to do what he wants with his father's wealth, though he couldn't just sell it. Yet that's exactly what the younger brother does, which again is brutal. And we know he did it quick because Jesus says, not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country. And you know, Jesus didn't have to say not many days later. But he does, because he wants us to get a picture of this younger son as being in a hurry. Even though we know the father's clearly generous and kind, given the way he responded, the younger son just wants to get out. So he gathers all he has. And how did he do that? Because his inheritance would have been property. And you can't really take land and stuff like that to a far country. So when it says he gathered all he had, it means he turned everything he was given into cash. And that's actually how one translation puts it. A few days later, the younger son turned the whole of his share into cash and left home for a distant country. And this, of course, is not super smart. Because if you feel like you have to sell things quickly, what usually happens? What usually happens is you get taken advantage of, and especially back then. Apparently, negotiations in those days normally took a long, long time. There's a lot of haggling that would go on. So if you were impatient, you were selling at a loss. And that's got to be so difficult for the whole family to watch. And was also going to be really shameful for them because, you know, he wasn't like selling all of this on the internet to strangers. He's living in a village where everybody knows everybody else. And yet he's going out there and trying to sell his family's property, which they wouldn't have thought he had the right to do. Like, this is weird. Sort of like a son selling his dad's Cadillac or something. And so he's going to have to do some explaining. And all the explaining that he's doing is only going to bring more and more shame on his father. Wait, you told your father to give you the inheritance? And he did? Like, first of all, how much do you hate him? And then why would he do that? That's not what a dad's supposed to do. And so they're all shaking their heads and talking about this over dinner. But the younger brother doesn't seem to care, you know? He just wants to get out of there. And so he gathers all he has and takes a journey into a far country. And that means he actually leaves Israel. So he's going to live among Gentiles, which wasn't something anyone would have thought was a great idea. And he's doing it in a way that's going to make it very, very, very difficult for him to ever come back. And not just because of what his dad might think, but also the whole community. I was thinking even now, if you have someone you know who abuses and humiliates their father publicly, and you're close to that father, and you see that person coming back, you're going to feel protective. Like, do you know what you did? Do you know how you made him feel? And back then, there would have been even more going on than that. Because again, this was the promised land, right? And you have thousands of pages of the Old Testament telling you how important this place was if you were part of Israel. And how important that property was to your family. And so leaving the promised land was going to be a big deal because you're not just making a statement about your dad, you're making a statement about God and about your people. And then even worse than leaving, is taking what belonged to God's people and giving it away to Gentiles. That would have been super shameful. And Kenneth Bailey writes, he's a scholar who's written a lot about the prodigal son. He writes, first century Jewish custom had a way of dealing with someone who did something like that. It dictated that if a Jewish boy lost the family inheritance among the Gentiles and he dared to return home, the community would meet him and they would break a large pot in front of him and cry out, so-and-so is cut off from his people. And they even had a name for that. The ceremony was called the Kazaza ceremony, literally the cutting off. And after it was performed, the community would have nothing to do with the wayward person. So by selling his inheritance and taking it with him, the prodigal takes a huge risk, because if he loses that money among the Gentiles, he burns his bridges and he has no way to return home. He has no more right to claim anything, and no one will take him in. But knowing all that doesn't faze him, and he takes this journey to a far country, and there he squandered his property in reckless living. And it happens quick, the way Jesus tells it, but we don't know how long it took in reality. I guess it depends how much money he had, but somehow he lost it. The word for squandered means scattered, so he scattered his money. And we don't really know how he did that, except that it says reckless living. Another way to say that would be loose living. But reckless basically just means that he wasted his money. We might wish Jesus would tell us more, but he doesn't say anything about wild parties or anything like that. We sort of put that idea back in there. Probably because the older brother did later. He says, this son of yours devoured your property with prostitutes. But if you think about it, he actually had no way of knowing that. Maybe he's right. Maybe he's not. Here, Jesus is just saying that he was not really being careful and he was spending his money in a foolish way, like it was never going to come to an end. But of course it did. And not only because he made bad choices, but also because he experienced some really, really difficult circumstances. Verse 14. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country and he began to be in need. And famine, of course, refers to a time when food becomes really, really scarce. And a severe famine is usually referring to a time when a famine occurs over multiple years. It's a specific way of talking. And so that's hard for us to imagine. I think we might even read over that part of the story and barely notice, because we've grown up in places where there's always food somewhere. If we miss one meal, we feel like it's a challenge. But imagine day after day going to look for food and there's nothing. It's going to get a little hectic pretty quick. I mean, what happens now when people think there's not going to be enough toilet paper because of the supply chain? People go crazy. And the world is going to get really, really hard if people don't think there's enough food, especially for individuals who don't have many resources, which means this younger brother is in trouble because he's spent everything he's had and he's living far, far from home. And it's hard to be a foreigner anywhere, because you don't have your normal support systems. But it's going to be much, much harder when you're a poor foreigner living somewhere where people are scared that they don't have enough resources. And they are going to be really, really hard on you. And they definitely were. It doesn't seem like he had anyone who would help him. So verse 15, he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country who sent him into his field to feed pigs. And the word hired is generous, really, because it actually means attached himself. So it's not like he's getting paid. What happens sometimes when you live in a poor country where there are lots of poor people is that someone who's poor will meet you and they'll think you have money. And so all of a sudden, they're your best friend. They attach themselves to you. And if you've ever experienced that, you know what I'm talking about. And that's what he's trying to do here with this citizen, someone who belongs in that country. And yet this citizen doesn't seem to really like this younger brother attaching himself to him, which you can understand if it's happened to you. Because he knows what this younger brother wants is help. And sometimes what you might do if you're not really, really a generous person, if a person attaches themselves to you like that, is give the person who attaches themselves to you something to do that you don't think they would ever want to do, because you don't want to shame yourself by acting like you're ungenerous and yet you do want to get rid of this person. Because if someone is desperate, it is really hard, actually, to get them to go away. You can sort of subtly tell them to go away, but they don't usually do it. So you might give them a job that they'll hate, and they'll get tired of it. And that's what this citizen does. He knows this young man is a Jew, and Jewish people had certain animals that they thought were gross for reasons. And we have animals like that. Maybe for us, it's mice. I don't know. So he gives this young man the responsibility of feeding his pigs, which I was trying to think of a job that would make us feel ashamed, and I don't know what that job would be for you, but there's probably one. And this would have been a job that would have made a Jewish person ashamed, for sure. Like, pick your jobs. Way worse than being a shepherd, being a pig herder. And yet, he is so desperate that he does it, even though he's not really getting anything out of it, except this hope that maybe the person he's working for will give him something, but he doesn't. He doesn't. So he's sitting out there with the pigs, and he's looking at these pigs and wishing that he could be eating what they were eating, verse 16. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. And that last phrase is so sad. The whole thing is so sad. But imagine watching a group of mice eat a used lollipop from the trash and be so hungry that you were just longing that you could get a lick in there as well. Because that's kind of what this is. A pod was the thing that goes around a seed. This is probably a carob pod, they say. I don't know much about pods, but apparently it was barely edible. And yet he's looking at these pigs and he's wishing that he could just eat one of these pods with them. In other words, he's at his absolute, absolute end. And this is a picture where sinful choices take you, right? Like, that's the point. Jesus is eating with these people and celebrating. And I don't know, maybe the Pharisees are thinking, does he not know how terrible sin is? And Jesus is like, I know. This is what it's like. It's short-sighted. It's foolish. It breaks your relationships. It's insane. It alienates you from others. It brings you shame. And even the prodigal son is starting to feel some of that, some of these consequences. As he's sitting out there watching those pigs, he starts thinking a little. Jesus says in verse 17, but when he came to himself, and it's like we sort of are watching him come out of this fog that he's been in. And finally, he's starting to think a little more clearly, or at least have some common sense. And Jesus tells us that. He said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? Which is maybe a start in the right direction, but you're going to have to slow down a little here. Because what does he seem concerned about to you, mostly? I think it's his physical condition, which makes sense when you're starving, so we can't give him too hard a time. Except that you kind of wish he would have said something about the way he hurt his dad as well. But he doesn't. Instead, he's just thinking about how hungry he is and remembering how good his father's hired servants have it. He says they have more than enough bread. And so again, his father's clearly generous. Even his servants are prosperous. And yet he's like, I'm dying of hunger here. And so he makes a plan, verse 18. I'll arise. And that's an interesting word for Jesus to use. I will arise. And some people read into it a resurrection kind of idea. Like, I'm dead here, and I need a resurrection. Because it's the same word. And I'm going to do it. I'm going to find a way to bring myself back from the dead. Though maybe that seems like a little much. But it's repeated a couple times, the word arise. And it's a strange enough word to make you wonder. Because it can mean stand up, or it can mean be raised from the dead. And at the end, the father does describe what happened as a kind of resurrection. If you look at verse 24, for this my son was dead and is alive again. So there's a reason people wonder about that. But at the very least, we can say he knows he needs a change. And so he's taken some action. I will arise and I will go to my father and I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you, which sounds really good. And we're like, this is the part of the story. Here we are. And we're kind of expecting repentance, given what we read in the other stories. But again, I think we need to slow down and that actually we might be missing the point if we think this is the climax. Like, aha, this is what I'm talking about. This is what Jesus means by seeking sinners. They figure it out, and they come back. For one thing, because the sheep didn't do that, right? And the coin didn't do that, right? And if you look at what he says here, this son, I'm not sure he's actually repenting yet. Because what he says here is the same exact thing that Pharaoh said to Moses in Exodus 10:16. Like, literally the same words. And Jesus is talking to people who are very familiar with the Old Testament. Again, remember, scribes, their job, write down the scriptures. And they're all going to be familiar with this story because they talked about it at least once a year on Passover. And you remember how Pharaoh was trying to get to manipulate Moses so that he could get some relief from the consequences. So finally he says to Moses, I've sinned against the Lord your God and against you. Now therefore, forgive my sin, please. And we know that Pharaoh was not sincere. So I'm not totally sold on this being genuine at this point, especially if you look at what he says next. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And again, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son sounds kind of good, and we don't want to overanalyze this, but it does make you wonder, does he understand the kind of father he has? Is this really how a father who would give him his inheritance the way he did would act when he came back? And actually, you press on it, and it's still like he's thinking in terms of what he deserves. First, he says, give me my inheritance. I deserve my inheritance. I'm your son. Then he says, I lost the inheritance. I'm not worthy to be your son. But let me give you a plan. I'll tell you a plan. And he's even sort of commanding still, isn't he? Treat me as one of your hired servants. This is what you need to do. And why does he say it like that? He says it like that because hired servants get paid. And so he's not expecting to come back and be reconciled to his father. But he wants to go back and work for him. Probably, honestly, to try to pay off his debt. Because if he went back to his community after having lost his inheritance, the community is going to want to punish him. You remember, they had that whole ceremony where they cut you off for doing something like that. So he thinks he needs to work his way back in. And it's indicative of just how so many people think a relationship with God works. He starts off assuming his father should treat him a certain way, though he doesn't really want a relationship with his father. Then he goes and he acts foolishly, experiences the consequences of his actions, and he wants to go back, but not primarily because he wants to fix the relationship with his father, but because his father has things he thinks he needs. And he doesn't go back hoping for sonship, but to work his way back in. And that's definitely how the Pharisees thought of it. You know, which is why they've got to be looking at this younger brother and thinking, man, he got what he deserved. Jesus, you can end the story there if you're talking about the tax collectors and prostitutes with him looking at those pigs and wishing to be fed. But, okay, if you're not going to end the story there, then you can end it here. Because this strategy would at least make some sense to the Pharisees. Come back, be shamed for a long time, work, 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 do all these things right, and maybe someday your father will glance at you again. But that's not how this story goes, is it? Because what happens next, verse 20, and he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And we're going to talk about all this more when we come back to the parable again, because there's a lot here. But what I want you to see right now is this is all grace. Because while he's still a long way off, his father saw him. And so it's like he's eagerly anticipating his return, though he really has no idea when this son was coming back or even if he would. But still he's waiting. And when he sees him, he feels compassion. And why do you think Jesus chooses that particular word, compassion? Because it's so specific, compassion. He felt compassion. Maybe he's looking like someone who just came from a place where there was a severe famine and he hadn't eaten in days. That's probably one reason. But another possible reason is because he knows how he's going to be treated if anyone from the village sees him. Because I'm telling you, unless the father takes action, they're not going to be welcoming him back. They're going to be like, you got what you deserved. Look at you. This is what you did brings you. And they're going to be shaming him. So the father runs. Maybe because he wants to get to his son before anyone else does. And seeing this old man running like this would have been shocking because old men did not run. And so they're not just going to be talking about the son coming back anymore. They're also going to be talking now about the way the father reacted when he did. He's running, he's embracing him, and he's kissing him. And Jesus is quoting another Old Testament passage there that we'll talk about another time. Maybe you can see if you can find it this week, because that's actually key to the next part of the story. But this is a lot of emotion. And the son tries to give his speech, verse 21. And the son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And what does the father do? He cuts him off, right? He doesn't even give him the time to finish the speech he's prepared. It's actually like the father isn't even listening. Instead, he talks to his servants who must have started running alongside of him when he started running to meet his son, as you imagine they would. Like, what is he doing? But the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet and bring the fattened calf and kill it and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. And be patient. We'll get into what he says exactly next week or the week after that. And also understand, this isn't everything about how the gospel works. But look, it is saying something important. If you're going to understand the gospel, you've got to understand it's not about us being worthy or not worthy. It's about God's grace. And you just will not get the gospel until you understand how good and generous God is. How everything is so dependent on that. And you know, of all the people in the world, the Pharisees are the ones who should have known that. Because that is literally the history of Israel. And that's why I said at the beginning, while we look at this parable and the prodigal son represents the tax collectors and the sinners, we can maybe take it a step further because actually, when the Pharisees heard about a father with two sons, a younger son and an older son, and an inheritance. If Jesus stopped there, you know who their sympathies would have been with? Their sympathies would have been with the younger brother, for sure. Because that's the story of Genesis. That's the story of Genesis. That's actually the story of Israel, where they got their name from. If you go back to the story of the man from whom the nation of Israel got their name, you're going to find a story about a father with two sons, Isaac and Jacob and Esau. And Jacob, who becomes Israel, is the younger son. And he acts shamefully in order to steal his inheritance from his brother. And then he's actually sent into a far country, into exile, where he is mistreated. And it's like Jesus is reminding the Pharisees as he tells this story, you know, you're so upset about me pursuing these sinners, and you're acting like a relationship with God is based on someone's performance and the way they kept God's law. But go back to the very beginning of Israel's relationship with God. And what do you see? You see it is God pursuing sinners to show them undeserving grace from the beginning. So the problem is not me seeking these sinners. I'm not bringing something totally out of step with the God who's revealed in the Old Testament. The problem is somehow you've gotten to the place in your life that you've forgotten how dependent you are on God's grace. And you know, I'm afraid that we can forget that too. It's so easy to lose sight of how much grace God's shown after a while of being a Christian. And we can start to forget how we got here. And I know that each of us has our story, but the only hope for any of us is that God's incredibly gracious and that he sent his son into the world to provide a salvation we could not earn by living a perfect life and dying a death he didn't deserve and rising from the dead and offering forgiveness of sins and the hope of eternal life, not to people who prove they deserve it, but to people who know they don't and come to him in faith. That's the kind of God that we serve. And that's our gospel. And if we believe that, that should impact the way we approach sinners. And I know it's not always going to be easy to know what to do, because sin is serious, and unrepentant sin is dangerous and insane, and life can get really complicated, and there can be a lot of reasons we may need to start pulling back, some good, some not so good. But listen, if we are starting to pull back because we feel the person's too lost, or some strange sense of we're better than them, that should be like a spiritual alarm that we need to go back and think about how salvation has to work, because we may be forgetting what we mean when we say it's got to be all God. Because yes, sin is terrible. The prodigal son makes that clear. But God is gracious. That's why Jesus came, to provide a salvation for people who don't deserve it. And we need to make sure that we remember that, we enjoy that, we believe that, and take the gospel out to them so that they can. And we're going to do a little of that remembering now, actually, by celebrating communion together. Because in communion, we're reflecting on how God acted to find us. Communion is for those of us who are believers. If you've repented and put your faith in Christ, you have been found. You have been found. You are found. That's your identity. And this is for you, to help you remember and to strengthen you to show God's grace to others. So take the cup and to take the bread. You have this little cup. You can pull the piece of plastic off and take the bread in your hand. And the bread represents Christ's body and the cup his blood. And we're remembering, even as we hold this in our hands, that for you to have a relationship with God took something bigger than a shepherd seeking his sheep. And it took something even bigger than a woman going out to search for a coin. You are sinful, and God is holy. So a debt was owed. The wages of sin is death. But God, surely because of his grace and kindness, sent his Son, the eternal Son of God, the eternally begotten Son of God, to become man, to unite himself to human nature, so that he could live a perfect life in obedience to God's law, do everything that we should have done, and then die a death he didn't deserve as a substitute, and take your punishment so that you could be found. Romans 5 puts it like this. Therefore, since we've been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Through him, we have obtained access by faith into this grace in which we stand, and we rejoice in hope of the glory of God. For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Take a moment and respond to the gospel and to the goodness of God.